Primarily on one specific topological superconductor. Is this volume good? Everyone can hear me? Okay, on one particular topological superconductor, strontium ruthenate, and whether it's realized in a particular material, it's going to be on the topological superconductor is chiral P wave, and whether it's realized in the material, strontium ruthenate. But I first wanted to start with some general comments about superconductivity more generally, and also about topological order. So I think, as you all know, superconductivity is a truly remarkable phenomenon. It's an example of quantum behavior on a macroscopic length scale. And its two defining properties, perfect conductivity and perfect diamagnetism, lead to such striking properties as magnetic flux quantization and persistent currents that can flow for the age of the universe without a battery. And understanding superconductivity rests on two of the most fundamental paradigms in condensed matter physics. Fermi liquid theory, which describes all metals, and in its even simpler formulation of band theory, it describes all metals and semiconductors and insulators. And the second paradigm is spontaneous symmetry breaking, which describes order in crystals and magnets. And in this case, the low energy or low temperature state is described by a local order parameter, which for a ferromagnet would just be the local magnetization. So Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer taught us that for even an arbitrarily weak attractive interaction, the Fermi liquid is unstable even in three dimensions to the formation of coherent pairs of electrons called Cooper pairs. And this theory is traditionally understood as an example, quite a striking example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. Here, the many-body wave function spontaneously picks out a global phase. So there's a global U1 symmetry that's broken, and the superconducting state is described by an order parameter, which is for the superconductor is a local pair amplitude, and in weak coupling, that's just proportional to the superconducting energy gap. So this BCS theory explains all the striking properties of superconductivity. It was a revolutionary step in understanding Fermi liquids. And these three theories together, that is Fermi liquid theory together with band theory, spontaneous symmetry breaking, and BCS, essentially allowed us to understand all known electron behavior in materials up to 1980. Sorry, I guess a little bit's getting cut off there. So in 1980, what happened is the quantum Hall effect was discovered, and shortly after that, the fractional quantum Hall effect. It was only with these discoveries that a new way of looking at the nature of quantum ground states in condensed matter began to emerge. And it was really that discovery, coupled with one that followed just a few years later, which is the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity in the Coupe rates. So again, in this problem of high-temperature superconductivity are three paradigms, including BCS as a paradigm, you know, failed to explain the behavior observed in these materials. And in fact, high TC is still an unsolved problem. It's an area that I'm currently working on. But it's generated many new ideas and concepts. And it was really the combined discoveries of the quantum Hall effect and high TC superconductivity, in particular, some spin liquid models that were proposed to explain the behavior in the Coupe rates, that led Xiaogan Wen at MIT to try and classify these different quantum many-body states according to the idea of topological order. So since Wen's seminal work two decades ago, introducing to condensed matter the idea of topological order, this has actually become a major research area in condensed matter. And this is topological order is actually another example of macroscopic quantum phenomena. Here there's a topological quantum entanglement that persists over the entire size of the crystal, leading to very special states at the edges or surface of the crystal, and also can give rise to new quasiparticles or excitations, which have quantum numbers that are fractions of the electron quantum numbers. These excitations are of interest to the quantum computing community, and I'll mention that a little bit later in the talk. So for the purposes of this talk, the two properties of topological order that are most important are the fact that we're talking about a state that has an energy gap in the bulk, so there's no low-lying excitations in the bulk, but there's gapless edge modes, which are special in that they carry the topological signature of the state. And this state may support new quasiparticles with fractionalized quantum numbers. First, I think I should mention, I don't know how well appreciated this is, but I mentioned that superconductivity traditionally is understood as an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. Actually, in the last decade, we've come to appreciate that it's more accurately described as an example of topological order. And although this was first pointed out by Wen, there's quite a lengthy and informative paper by Sondi and collaborators in 2004 discussing this issue. And interestingly, it's not just a reclassification. We actually learned some new things about superconductivity in that it has a degeneracy. If you have a 2D superconductor that you put on the surface of a torus, for example, there's a fourfold degeneracy. However, for this talk, I want to make the point that I'm going to be talking about a topological superconductor which has an additional topological order that is in addition to the topological order that is necessarily implied by having a coherent pairing that any superconductor would have. And the superconductor I'm going to talk about is what Morris Rice referred to as superconductivity with a twist. So Morris Rice was referring to strontium ruthenate. This is a material that actually has the same crystal structure as the cuprates. It's a quasi two-dimensional material. Its electronic properties are a little bit more complicated because there's three bands that cross the Fermi energy, so that means there's three separate sheets to the Fermi surface. However, it's believed that the superconductivity is predominantly on this yellow sheet of the Fermi surface, the so-called alpha band, which to a good approximation is just a cylinder. And the fact that it's a cylinder with no warping and dispersion along the c-axis tells you that you got a quasi two-dimensional material with very, basically a layered material with very weak coupling between the layers. So in 1994, Yoshi Miyano in Japan discovered superconductivity in this material below 1.5 Kelvin. So we're obviously not interested in this material because of its high transition temperature. We're interested in it because it's believed to have a very special pairing symmetry. So shortly after its discovery in the late 90s, some key experiments gave us important information about the pairing symmetry in strontium ruthenate. And I won't go through the details, just to state the results. There's NMR measurements pointed towards triplet pairing in strontium ruthenate. So this is unlike conventional superconductors like lead or aluminum, which are S-wave and singlet pairing, and unlike the cuprates, which have D-wave pairing, but that's still singlet. So we're talking about pairing electrons, so that pair wave function has to be antisymmetric under interchange. So if you're talking about a triplet, you need an odd angular momentum to go with it. So the simplest case for triplet pairing would be P-wave pairing, where the two electrons form a bound state, the Cooper pair, in a P-wave orbital. Muon spin resonance is a technique that measures fields inside samples. And in strontium ruthenate, they saw additional internal magnetic fields that just turned on below TC. So this suggests that the superconducting state itself induces some kind of magnetic moment or internal fields along with the superconductivity. And so that's telling us to look for a superconducting order parameter that breaks time reversal symmetry, as fields do. So it turns out if you put these pieces of information together, that you're talking about a triplet P wave with broken time reversal symmetry. Put that together with the cylindrical Fermi surface and some energetic considerations, that points to a unique superconducting order parameter, and that's chiral P wave. So since it's a triplet, there's both a spin part and an orbital part to the order parameter. I want to say something first about the spin part. So it's believed because of the spin-orbit coupling in strontium ruthenate that the spin state of the Cooper pair aligns such that it has zero projection along the c-axis. So let's call that the z-axis. So we're in an z equals zero state, as I've written here. And I just want to point out we could equally well write that exact same state as equal spin pairing in the xy plane. Just, you know, instead of quantizing along the z-axis, say we quantized along the x-axis. So exactly what phases you get here depends whether you quantize along the x-axis or the y-axis. But anywhere in the xy plane, the important point is they have equal amplitude, and it's called equal spin pairing. I point that out because I'm going to use that fact when I talk about vortices in the system. But for the moment, I want to talk about the orbital part of this wave function. So that's that px plus or minus ipy. The plus or minus I is telling us we have broken time reversal symmetry. Plus or minus corresponds to two chiralities, and it implies that the Cooper pair has an angular momentum of plus or minus one. So this chirality is the twist that Morris Rice talked about. These two chiralities are degenerate with each other. So in principle, you could have, in a sample, you could have domains of these two chiralities coexisting. However, the domain walls cost you energy. And unlike a ferromagnet, there's no other energetic considerations that would actually favor domain formation. So if you had a perfect ideal crystal and you cooled down very slowly, you would expect one domain. Under real situations, you'd probably get some domains. I also want to point out that the magnitude of this order parameter, that is the magnitude of the superconducting gap, is just a constant, a gain because of that, plus or minus I, and that tells you that energetically this is a good state. It has a nice isotropic gap around the Fermi surface. Most P wave states would have zeros on the Fermi surface if you didn't have this I here, and those would not be as energetically favorable. So this same state, this chiral P wave state, is known with certainty to exist in superfluid helium-3. It's the A phase, so it's only under pressure. And that's known with certainty because helium-3 is isotropic fluid. So when you form a chiral P wave state, that means you're breaking a lot of symmetries. I mean, in addition to whatever topological order you have, you're breaking not only time reversal symmetry, but you have to pick out a direction for your spins. You have to pick out a direction for your angular momentum. All of these give rise to collective modes, and those have been measured with great accuracy. The B phase is also an interesting phase, but it's a different topological phase. And there's proposals for stabilizing this phase in cold atomic gases. However, if you imagine you might want to build a quantum computer, it's a lot easier to move vortices around in a solid state superconductor than to deal with helium-3 and probably the atomic gases too. So I mentioned that in this chiral P wave state, the Cooper pairs carry angular momentum 1. The entire BCS ground state, that's the condensate, carries angular momentum n h bar over 2. There's, the 2 comes from Cooper pairing. This n is the number of conduction electrons. So this is a macroscopic angular momentum involving all your conduction electrons. So this is a surprising result. It's actually what you would expect in the other limit of extreme strong coupling in Bose-Einstein condensation. So if you just really crank up your attractive interaction, it's so strong you bind all your electrons all the way down to the bottom of the conduction band, and they're bound into tightly bound pairs that don't overlap. They're each orbiting around with angular momentum 1. You just add up all the moments, and this is the angular momentum you get. Okay, so that's easy. But this result comes out of BCS theory in arbitrarily weak coupling. So there you have these large Cooper pairs because they're weakly bound, and you've only paired electrons that are within delta of your Fermi surface. In strong ruthenate, that would say you paired about 10 to the minus 4 of your electrons. But BCS theory tells you it doesn't matter. You could have paired 10 to the minus 10 of your electrons, and you'd still get this macroscopic angular momentum. So this is what is known as the angular momentum paradox. There's actually a very long literature spanning a couple decades on this, a lot of controversy. Some theorists have said, it shouldn't be this result. It should be down by a factor of delta over EF. Others have said it should be down by a factor of delta over EF squared. Tony Leggett still believes that it should be down by a factor of delta over EF squared, and he has some proposals in his book on helium-3. But the point is that this is what comes out of BCS theory, and in fact, it's connected to the fact that chiral P wave is a topological state. So interestingly, the strong coupling is not a topological state, although it gives you this nice simple angular momentum. But remember I said topological states have these edge states, and you don't need that many particles zooming around the edge of your sample to give you a large macroscopic angular momentum if you have a macroscopic system. So this is all connected to the topology of the state. I'll skip that and just say that it was shown by Reed and Green that the chiral P wave state is a topological state. It has exactly, it's analogous to the Moore-Reed state that's proposed to explain the 5-half state in the quantum Hall system. So it's characterized by a topological integer, the Chern number, which is plus or minus 1 depending on what chirality you have. And that comes about because of this winding or twist in the order parameter, as well as the pairing nature, which gives you a Hamiltonian describing the superconducting state that has this 2x2 structure. That's the what's known as the BDG, Bugler-Bothe-Degen Hamiltonian. So those two pieces together lead to the topology. And what I've shown here is just the spectrum one would calculate for a superconductor on a finite disk. The BDG spectrum always, it doubles the spectrum because of this 2x2 structure due to pairing. So one should think of this that all the states with energy less than zero are occupied in the ground state, and it's your E greater than zero are describing your excitations. So you see that there's a gap, delta. These are your bulk continuum states. There's a gap delta to them, but there's a special mode here, which if you look at the states, it corresponds to states localized at the edge of the sample, and it's chiral. It goes in a given direction here, depending on whether you've chosen a plus I or a minus I in your order parameter. If I chose the other one, it would have gone in this direction. So there's these edge states that give you a large angular momentum. Actually, they're not the whole story of the angular momentum. It turns out that the bulk states also scatter at the edges, and they give a contribution to the angular momentum too. And it's really the sum of these two contributions that gives you that simple n h bar over 2. So if you're in helium 3, what this implies is that there's a large mass current flowing around the edge of a superfluid helium 3 sample in the A phase. In the superconductor, it's not quite as simple because these excitations, these aren't excitations, sorry, this is an equilibrium ground state property, but it's made up of, our system's made up of electrons which carry charge. And so when you have this mass current flowing around the edge, you also have a charge current flowing around the edge, and that will induce a magnetic field inside the superconductor. If you imagine a real 3D superconductor, say, made up of these weakly coupled 2D sheets, and you can't have a large field inside your superconductor. That's the perfect diamagnetism, or the Meissner effect. So there has to be an equal and opposite screening current. So the spontaneous equilibrium currents, these red arrows, are localized within the coherence length of the surface. In strontium ruthenate, that's about 600 angstroms. There's an equal and opposite screening current within the penetration depth plus the coherence length of the surface. Penetration depth is about 1,800 angstroms. So these two currents together ensure that inside the superconductor, your magnetic field is zero. However, because of the different spatial distribution of these currents, there is a magnetic field around the edge of your sample. And it's not that small, because these currents are quite large. They connect to this large macroscopic angular momentum. It gives a field for strontium ruthenate that's about 10 Gauss. And I should say, here I've assumed that we've got a single domain. If we had multiple domains, you'd just have these currents flowing around each domain, and so there's similar fields at the domain walls. So one could look for these fields in strontium ruthenate experimentally, and that's exactly, one way to do that is with a scanning squid, which is basically just measuring the magnetic flux through this pickup loop, and that's exactly the experiment that was done by the Stanford group. So these are experiments done by John Kirtley and Catherine Moeller. And actually, this is where I myself first became interested in strontium ruthenate and chiral P-wave when I was visiting Stanford and got involved in this work. So what I've shown here is just some typical experimental scan. So this is the amount of flux measured as a scan across the top surface of strontium ruthenate. This is the edge of the sample, and then they're scanning across the epoxy that's holding the sample in place. I've superimposed the theoretical prediction. So this is the theoretical prediction, you know, corrected the, you know, for the size of the pickup loop, the distance above the sample, in the fact that you have your fields fringe out above the superconductor. And you can see there's a whopping big discrepancy. You see this actually goes up to, past the ceiling there. So there's a huge discrepancy, and that was in 2007. Since then, there's been several other papers, including some work that's just been submitted, where they've increased their sensitivity using smaller squid devices, smaller samples. In all cases, they failed to see these spontaneous the fields due to the spontaneous supercurrents. So in fact, the current experimental situation is that they put upper bounds on these edge currents, which are about three orders of magnitude smaller than predicted. So that's a real problem for reconciling chiral P wave with the superconductivity in strontium ruthenate. On the other hand, I mentioned already that USR saw broken time reversal symmetry. You know, what are the fields they're seeing? The early data was interpreted in terms of they're seeing fields due to domain walls inside the sample. So that's exactly the same type of supercurrents, that these experiments have been looking for. And the idea to going to submicron samples was that they're so small, there's no way there should be domains in those samples. So that's a bit of a puzzle. I should also say muon expects a signal just because, you're putting a muon in your sample, which is a defect in chiral P wave, and that in itself will induce a field. And some of the more recent Japanese USR data has been interpreted with both of these contributions. I particularly want to mention this polar Kerr effect measurement done by Kapitolnik's group at Stanford, because this is a very nice technique that just directly measures the chirality of the order parameter. It doesn't depend at all on any supercurrents. It's getting in there and seeing whether you have a plus or minus I. It's actually checking for an angular momentum one rotation of the Cooper pairs, and it actually gave a positive result. I mean, there's still a little bit of a puzzle here in that The result they got was actually larger in magnitude than the theoretical prediction, and that's a little bit of a puzzle. It's actually an interesting result because it involves Galilean invariance and pretty general arguments. So you know, that remains to be solved. On the other hand, it does seem to be saying that you have a angular momentum one Cooper pairing, which, you know, putting together, you know, which would point towards chiral P wave. So this is all a bit, you know, it's a bit up in the air. One point I should make is that the spontaneous supercurrents, you know, that I said connect to this angular momentum n h bar over 2, that itself is not a topological invariant. You know, so I mean, first of all, actually, angular momentum has to be a good quantum number to get exactly that result, n h bar over 2. However, it is a result that is connected to the topological invariant in that these edge states, these chiral edge states, make a major contribution to that angular momentum and hence to the edge currents. And there's big constraints on those edge states. They can be changed somewhat by disorder, but there's a lot of things that you can't do to them. For example, they can't be localized by disorder. All that can happen is that some edge states, you can lose them as they merge in with the continuum. And so if you do calculations, you know, with strong disorder scattering or anisotropy, putting in all the things that have been left out of simple theories, it turns out that at best you get a 30% reduction in these edge currents, and we're looking for three orders of magnitude, so we've got a big problem. So there's one idea that's, you know, still being worked out. It's this idea from, again, a Stanford group of re-examining this question that the superconductivity is on the cylindrical band, and saying, what if it's on the other two bands, which are called quasi-1D bands, because those bands actually came from these one-dimensional Fermi surfaces that are just sheets. So there's no dispersion in two directions. And then they hybridize. So you get two bands. You get an electron band and a hole band here. And that's the alpha bands, the hole band. Beta is the electron band. So I'm going to show some BDG calculations for this 1D model in a strip geometry, so that means you have two edges here. And first, in the upper part of this slide, it's just showing you the spectrum that you get for the superconductivity on the 2D band, which is what's being assumed. So you see these nice chiral modes. You know, now we have both of them because there's two edges and it flows, you know, for a given chirality, it flows in the opposite sense on the two edges. Okay, so that's our nice topological result. Look what you get for the 1D bands. You still get edge modes, but they're not chiral. They don't connect the lower band to the upper band. And the reason for that is because we have two bands. One's electron-like and one's hole-like. The topological churn number depends not only on the chirality, but on the charge of the carriers. So if you change that sign, you change the sign of the churn number, meaning that the total churn number for the system is zero, and anything with a topological number of zero means it's not topologically protected. It's topologically trivial, you know, like an ordinary metal is. So there's no topological protection, and that sort of shows up in not having chiral states, and so you could localize these states, and this, you know, may result, you know, this could possibly give you the reconcile the Kerr rotation with the absence of these supercurrents. It's not a done deal because actually there's some very recent work just appeared in Nature on bilayer graphene that shows even when these states aren't topologically protected. It's a different problem, bilayer graphene, but there's some similarities there that they can localize, but they localize very weakly, and the reduction is not nearly what one might have hoped. So there's still work remains to be done, and also this would not explain the MuSR. The problem with the MuSR is, you know, they're interpreting it in terms of domain walls, which have the same currents that the SQUID measurements failed to see. Okay, so there's puzzles, but I want to move on to, you know, the topic I'm going to be talking about for the rest of this talk. which has to do with vortices in these systems and the possibility of Majorana zero modes. So first of all, in any superconductor, the elementary excitations in a superconductor are linear combination of electron-like excitations and hole-like excitations. And this falls directly from the fact that you have that a superconductor is pairing, and it comes from that 2x2 structure of the BDG Hamiltonian. So a dagger here creates an electron-like quasiparticle in the normal metal. And A destroys it, which means it's like creating a hole in the normal metal. Gamma dagger will create an excitation in the superconductor. And so that's totally general. But it also, if you look at the structure of the 2x2 BDG Hamiltonian, for the special case where you're looking at possible solutions with zero energy, then one finds that you have perfect particle hole symmetry, and the magnitude of U and V are identical. In fact, they're just related by complex conjugation, U and V. So for a zero energy solution, this is the structure of your particle creation operator. And you notice if you take the Hermitian adjoint of this operator, you just get the same operator back again. So this is supposed to destroy a particle. That's supposed to create a particle. They're the same. For this reason, it's called a Majorana fermion in analogy with the 3+1 dimensional particles proposed by Majorana, which are particles that are their own antiparticle. So that's what this is. It's a particle that's its own antiparticle, although these tend to be in 2+1 field theories. I guess there's one point here. I'm assuming that these have the same quantum numbers, so we're either talking about spinless electrons or the same spin, which is a possibility in a triplet state, not in a singlet state. If these had opposite spin, then you wouldn't have this last equal sign. So that's important for Majorana fermions. So, and if you want to create an ordinary fermion creation operator, you need two Majorana operators, and that's because you need to create something that is distinct from its adjoint, and to do that with gammas you need two of them. If you identify it this way as a sum of two Majorana operators, you can check that CNC dagger obey the usual fermion commutation relations because the gammas here obey Fermi commutation relations, and so that means that a Majorana fermion is like half of an electron. And you need two Majorana fermion levels to accommodate one electron. Turns out that these Majorana fermions, they always come in pairs, and that comes straight out of the BCS-BDG theory. But what's special about topological states is that, yes, they still always come in pairs, but these pairs can be spatially separated. And that's important because, see, if you had two zero modes, which can happen sometimes even in an ordinary superconductor, if there are two identical zero modes, then you might as well describe those as fermions. There's no exotic physics going on. But if you have two Majorana fermions that are spatially separated, means what, for example, one at the edge of a sample that has two edges, one at each edge, or one in a vortex, we'll see in a minute, where you have two separated vortices. If you then add one extra electron to the system, its amplitude will show up in these two distinct places in your sample because it needs those two states to accommodate that one electron. So this is an example of fractionalization, and it's something that can happen when you have a topologically ordered state, and it's not something that happens just due to broken symmetry. So I want to talk about vortices. And first, in any type 2 superconductor, which is what strontium ruthenate is, the magnetic field can penetrate in the form of vortices where the Cooper pair amplitude or the Cooper pair wave function amplitude vanishes at the center of the vortex, but its phase winds by 2 pi around the vortex. And so this is a wave function describing a charged 2e object. It's winding by 2 pi. That means that the flux associated with this vortex sorry, it's getting cut off. It's hc over 2e. It's exactly half the fundamental flux quantum, and that's what we just call the superconducting flux quantum. That's what happens in regular superconductors. If you have a triplet superconductor, something more interesting can happen, because you have a spin and orbital part of your order parameter, or Cooper pair wave function, and they can each rotate around the vortex. So here I've written triplet order parameter where I've written the spin part in this equal spin pairing language. So this could be my chiral P wave state with S at equals zero, but I've just quantized along the x-axis. And if I now imagine this phase, if I let it wind by theta over 2, where theta is the angle I'm going to take through 2 pi as I go around a vortex, which means I'm changing the spin state. You know, for, you know, say I started at alpha equals 0, that's a set representation of S, Z equals 0, and now I'm actually letting it wind. So it means that you're changing the triplet spin state, but staying in this Hilbert space of mixed equal spin pairing. Then notice that I just have to let the orbital part also wind by theta over 2 in order to have a single-valued Cooper pair wave function. But if the orbital part is the only part that carries the charge, you know, spin doesn't. It's the only part that couples to the magnetic flux. So if the orbital part is winding by theta over 2, that means it's winding by a total of pi, and you're winding a 2e object around, that means you're enclosing a quarter of the fundamental flux quantum, or half of the usual superconducting flux quantum. So this is what we call a half quantum vortex in a superconductor. I also want to point out that this vortex is actually a vortex in only one spin component, because notice I've got e to the I theta over 2 here, e to the I theta over 2, those just add. These cancel out. So there's no winding at all in the down-down component. The whole winding is in up-up. And so it's just the up-up component is the only one that sees the vortex. The other component just goes on unperturbed. So I should mention, you know, at this point, I didn't actually use any details of delta P. So I didn't use the fact that this was a chiral P wave superconductor. Didn't come into this argument at all. In fact, you don't need a chiral P-wave superconductor. You don't need a topological superconductor to, in principle, have half quantum vortices. What you need is a triplet superconductor. In fact, you need a triplet with equal spin pairing, of which chiral P-wave is one example. But, you know, a much more ordinary P-wave superconductor could equally well stabilize half quantum vortices. So what's special about chiral P-wave and the fact that it's topological? What's special is that if you look at the energy spectrum for quasiparticle excitations in the presence of a vortex, you find that there's exactly one zero mode. It means there's one Majorana fermion at the center of that vortex. That's a result that would not happen in an ordinary superconductor, where typically you would not have any zero modes. You might have some accidental degeneracy where you'd have two zero modes, which would be just an ordinary fermion. But so this is special to the topology of the state, that it supports a single Majorana fermion at the center of the vortex. And you need a half quantum vortex. If you had a full quantum vortex in chiral P wave, you'd get double this. You'd get basically an ordinary fermion at the center at zero energy. And in fact, perturbations could perturb that. So in general, it might be at finite energy. So you have a single Majorana fermion and at each vortex. And furthermore, Ivanov showed that if you take two of these vortices and you move them around each other in the presence of other vortices, and that's moving them around with their Majorana fermions, you find that they have a very non-trivial winding statistics. They have a billion braiding statistics, which means that as you move them around, you're not just picking up phase factors from moving particles, fermionic Majorana fermions around each other, that you're actually moving between distinct degenerate ground states as you move these vortices around. So there's a degeneracy here, again, associated with the topology in the presence of vortices, and you're moving between these different ground states, all of which were protected by their topological stability, and that's exactly what they want for quantum computing. So there's a lot of interest in discovering systems that have these half-quantum vortices under conditions that support these Majorana fermions. So in principle, since the Cooper pair wave function was single-valued, that means that these are allowed excitations. You know, they're topologically allowed, but do they exist? They'll depend on the energetics. Well, first of all, you know, it's always better to have two single vortices than one double vortex if you just look at the magnetic energy. There's a magnetic energy that goes like B squared or the flux squared, so it's better to have two individual ones. So that sounds good for half-quantum vortices. Unfortunately, that's not the whole story. There's also supercurrents that flow around when you have vortices. And in this case, because we have a vortex in only one spin component, it means that there's actually spin currents. I mean, usually in a vortex, the up and down spins are doing the same thing. So there's no net spin current. There's just a charge current around the vortex. But here, because we've only got one spin component at play in the vortex, there's a spin current. And if you look at the energy associated with that, it's big. And the reason is, if you look at this is what's called the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson free energy, looking at the energetics of these currents, this is the ordinary term one usually has of the supercurrents and they couple to the electromagnetic vector potential. There's an additional term here due to the spin currents, and they don't couple to the electromagnetic potential. You know, there's no charge, it's just spin. And that means there's no screening. And so it's this coupling to A that ensured there was screening that meant this term was finite for an ordinary vortex. This term will diverge logarithmically with the size of your system. So that tells you if you want to have half-quantum vortices, you better look at really tiny samples where your whole sample is small so that log L, the size of your system, isn't going to kill you. There's one other important point that's going to turn out is that Vakrick and Leggett showed that when you do have a half-quantum vortex, that you have a spin polarization that goes along with it. And the reason is just, you know, that the different spins, I said, we're doing different things. There's a supercurrent in one of the spins, not the other. And so if you solve things self-consistently, that means there's going to be a different occupation of the two spins. And that means there's going to be a polarization. So it turns out for the SZ equals zero state proposed for strontium ruthenate, this polarization would lie in the XY plane. So these energetic arguments, of course, again, don't depend on having chiral P wave. They're also true for triplet. The only point for chiral P wave is these Majorana fermions and all the grading statistics that goes along with it. So with that background, Rafi Boudakian at Urbana devised an experiment to look for these half-quantum vortices in strontium ruthenate. And this is unpublished results that I have his permission to speak about, although they can't show up on the web until they're published. Rafi, first of all, he made a number of these very tiny samples. Like it's only about a micron in size, got a big hole in the middle, making it even smaller. And he devised a very, an ultra-sensitive technique for measuring very tiny changes in magnetization. So the idea here, if you think in terms of vortices with a sample like this, first of all, the vortex will basically sit in this hole because that means it saves the core energy. It doesn't have to suppress the superinducting order parameter at all. So if you start with zero field, you're going to apply a field perpendicular to the sample, and you start from zero field and you just add a little bit of field. You know, there's going to be a little bit of flux going through this hole, but these superinducting electrons in the sample have to enclose an integral number of flux quantum, putting aside half, you know, half integral. Anyways, they have to enclose a quantized amount of flux. So there's only a little bit of flux here. There'll be supercurrents that exactly cancel the flux through the hole such that the effective flux, or what we call the fluxoid, as you imagine a path through the superinductor, is zero. You keep increasing the field, and there'll come a point where there's enough flux here that it'll suddenly switch to a state where the superinducting order parameter is picking up a phase of 2 pi now rather than zero and it's imposing a flux quantum. And you keep increasing it, you'll see two flux quantum, et cetera. So you expect jumps in the magnetization due to the integer flux. Now, actually, Rafi, I'll come to this in a minute, he also applied a field in the plane. But let's put that aside for the moment and just look at this, applying a field in the z direction, as I just described. So with no field in the plane, so that's this data curve here, starting from zero field. You keep applying field, you don't really see anything because there's screening currents and that, and then all of a sudden it jumps up where it, you're enclosing a whole flux quantum, and then it'll stay there until it'll jump up a second time, et cetera. Or going in the opposite direction, it encloses minus one of a flux quantum. So that's the totally standard result. And from the height of these jumps and this calibration, you can tell these are exactly flux quanta that he's seeing there. He then applies a field in the x direction. And look at what happens. One of these jumps here turns into two jumps. And in fact, the height change across these two jumps is the same as this one jump. That means that, you know, the sum of them adds up to a whole flux quantum. But it's split into two. Okay, this can be understood in terms of half quantum vortices. The idea here is that in zero, if you have hx equals zero, energetically the system would rather have integer flux quantum, presumably because of this log L term, core energies, whatever, would rather have integer flux quantum than half quantum vortices. So you just see these integer flux quantum. But remember, Tony Leggett's group found that if you do have a half quantum vortex, it comes along with a spin polarization that lies in the plane. And if you apply a field in the plane, it couples linearly, and that means you're lowering the energy of the half quantum vortex as you increase the in-plane field. And so that's the idea here, that applying a field will change this energy balance and stabilize half quantum vortices. So it's quite an exciting result. I mean, there are other things you might have to worry about. I think Rafi's done a careful job of trying to rule those out. But of course, it will also be interesting to see this result repeated and studied thoroughly when it's published. So I should mention that from all the quantities that Rafi measures, he can extract a value from his experiments for this induced polarization and compare it to theory. And it's actually a large polarization for his sample, 10 to the fourth Bohr magnetons. And the theory predicted somewhere between 2 and 3 Bohr magnetons. And that was using certain Fermi liquid parameters that are not well known for strontium ruthenate. So anyways, there's certainly good agreement with the theory there. So let me just end by saying that there's compelling evidence that strontium ruthenate is a triplet superconductor. I didn't talk about all the evidence, but I think that's pretty well settled. There's also a number of experiments that see evidence of broken time reversal symmetry. However, the absence of observable fields at surfaces that are expected from these spontaneous supercurrences is very puzzling. And perhaps here I should mention that actually they've never seen these mass flows in helium. I told you that in helium 3A, there's absolutely no uncertainty that you've got a chiral P wave. They've never, on the other, and that's through all the collective modes and that, they've never seen a signature that directly ties to the broken time reversal symmetry or the chirality, including these edge currents. Now, it's not the same as strontium ruthenate. It's not that there's null results. It's just that those experiments are very difficult if you think about, you know, coupling to a neutral current that's just at the edge of this helium-3 sample. However, I hear that there is a Japanese group which right now is setting up to do an experiment where they feel they'll have the sensitivity to measure this mass current at the edge in a thin plate geometry if it's of the expected magnitude. And in that system, you really do have this rotational symmetry, so it should be the full NH bar over 2. So that'll be very interesting. But in strontium ruthenate, we've got charge, and it shouldn't have been that hard to detect given the charge. So that is a real puzzle, and it's possible we need to learn more about chiral P wave or that there could be other pairing symmetries, although the energetics would certainly not suggest it. If you do have a chiral P wave, we'd certainly like to think about ways of directly probing the topological nature of that state. And, you know, there's some proposals. I mean, one proposal is there should be a quantized thermal conductivity. Again, this has not been measured, I think, for technical reasons. There's more abstract proposals. Nick Reed has proposed a Hall viscosity, although he hasn't told us how to measure it experimentally. You can calculate it on a computer and that, but it might also be a signature of this topology. On the other hand, if Budakin is really seeing half quantum vortices, and I stress there that that result, if it holds up, is telling you you have a triplet superconductor. That could never happen in a singlet superconductor. But in and of itself, it doesn't tell you you have a chiral P-wave superconductor. However, if it holds up, it tells you how to stabilize half quantum vortices for other experiments, such that you could check whether you have a chiral P-wave superconductor by checking whether there's Majorana and fermion modes in those half quantum vortices. And that is because there's proposals by DeSharma and others of interference effects by moving these vortices here using a flux flow measurement, where you look at interference between the vortices that would give distinct results if you actually had Majorana fermion mode. So I think that's an interesting future direction of using Budakin's stabilization technique for the half quantum vortices to check for interference effects, and that might be the most direct way to checking for the topology of the state in Strongheim-Ruth Nate. Thank you.
First of all, are there any questions from students in the audience?
A triplet superconductor? Yeah, so, you know, the key idea with any superconductor is this Cooper pairing, right? So you're pairing two electrons, you're just pairing them into a bound state. So you think of, you know, two fermions, you're pairing into a bound state, they have both spin and charge. So their spin degrees of freedom can pair either into a singlet, there's one state there, or a triplet, there's three states. And so that's really, you know, all that's going on in a triplet superconductor. In general, because you have three spin states, to really specify your superconducting triplet state, you usually have to specify three amplitudes. You know, what is the amplitude for up, up, down, down, and up, down, plus down, up. And that would totally specify your superconducting state. So for Strongheim-Ruth Nate, you know, I said it was in a specific state, that up, down, plus down, up, quantized along the set direction. But there's different ways of representing that, right? So I don't know if that's what you're thinking, but that's what the triplet. I mean, and I should say, you know, all conventional superconductors are singlets because they're S-waved. You know, they're just, you know, if you think about, you know, creating a bound state, you know, usually the lowest energy state is S-waved. It doesn't come with any angular momentum. It has a nice kinetic energy. But, you know, so typically, why would you get a triplet superconductor? It's usually because there's some lurking ferromagnetic fluctuations in your system that likes the spins of the electrons to be parallel to each other and hence rules out singlet formation. And that's what's going on in helium.
Couldn't there be a superconductor that makes both the single and triplet?
Yes. Yes, there could. Yes, and depends. You know, if you had a system that didn't have anything that broke, like if you didn't have spin orbit coupling, then you wouldn't expect that to happen. And Strongheim-Ruth Nate, actually, there's a lot of puzzles in Strongheim-Ruth Nate. I guess this. Most measurements suggest that the spin orbit coupling is relatively weak. And actually, that would be, it has to be weak if you're ever going to have half quantum vortices. I didn't mention this fact. You know, the fact that you're changing the spin state means, you know, you're actually moving those spins around. If you had a strong spin orbit coupling that just wanted, you know, those Cooper pairs to stay in that S equal zero state, you know, that's another energy cost for making a half quantum vortex to, you know, force the spins to wind around. Anyways, if you know, spin orbit coupling is perturbative, then to a good approximation, you should have either pure singlet or pure triplet. That probably should be re-examined in Strongheim-Ruth Nate because there's some new results from UBC, ARPA's results that's suggesting that spin orbit coupling, although weak in some sense, you know, might still be playing a stronger role in other senses.
So the matter that you are presenting is not necessarily in Jupiter's one dimension, right? So it's not a thin film. can be in a...
Yeah, it could be a bulk sample. Like I don't think anything I did relied on it. You don't need thin samples at all. It's really, we're working with these quasi-2D models because strontium ruthenate is a layered material, that is, a coupling between the layers is very weak. So through a good approximation, you solve a layer and then you just stack them together.
Question is, I suppose I want to understand this topological system using a 3+1 dimensional field theory. But how do I write down Lagrangian, for example, which is topological in the... To see these topological effects.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know the name of. I guess this it's probably just a Chern-Simons type theory,
but
Chern-Simons, right?
But usually you write it in 2+1.
Yes, that's right. Yes. So what's the 3D analog there? And actually, for the superconductor, it's not exactly a Chern-Simons because of the vector potential and the screening and that. But I don't know. But I don't know what the field theory is in 3+1 dimension, but I don't believe it should be a problem because if you really had a system, of course, if it's a three-dimensional system, then you have to ask why it picked out this AB plane or the XY plane. But in fact, that's what helium does. Now, the trouble with helium is it's really isotropic and has a Fermi surface that's a sphere. So if you take this KX plus KY pairing, opening a gap. I said it's isotropic for this layered system. In helium 3, there's actually nodes at the north and south pole. So when they want to look for half quantum vortices and that, they have to confine their helium in a thin sheet, basically, to avoid any. You don't want any low lying excitations in the bulk to preserve any of this topological stuff. It's important. In fact, the topology is protected by the bulk gap, and anything that weakens that will weaken the topology.
Okay, any more student questions before? Okay, let's open it up generally.
People understand why strontium ruthenate behaves differently from other materials?
It behaves differently in what way? You mean in that it's...
That's quite apparent.
There's closely related... there's different strontium ruthenates. This is 214. And closely related materials... first of all, I guess the ab initio calculations for strontium ruthenate do show that there's both anti-ferromagnetic and ferromagnetic fluctuations. So it isn't totally obvious, that you would get P-wave pairing or triplet pairing from that. But there are definitely ferromagnetic fluctuations around. The thing with this P-wave state, the fact that it gets an isotropic gap, is really good on the condensation energy, right? I mean, most exotic pairings won't do that. So that puts it in favor of the prior P-wave.
Questions?
Sorry, I'm just confused about something maybe very obvious. Is the half quantum vote, so you were saying it may be energetically disfavored because it has a log?
Right.
But is there a topological quantity which is conserved?
It's vorticity. Like any vortex, it is a topological excitation.
So then it doesn't matter.
But that's separate from the energetics. The topological excitation means, it has a definite winding, that once you have it, you can't change it.
But is it topologically stable?
It's topologically stable once you have it.
But then it doesn't matter if it's a logarithm. It's just the important thing is whether it's the lowest energy state
exactly.
in that topological sector. So is there any alternative state which doesn't have a log?
Look at the geometry of this experiment, this ring geometry. Mm-hmm. So, when you put a flux through that's not quite half a flux quantum, well, there isn't anything else you can do in your system that would actually have the phase wind by pi. But you could just have screening currents that turn that into zero flux. Right, so sure. I think those are the situations. You really have to compare the energetics of you know, trying to put half a flux quantum into your system and or close to that, and whether it'd want to turn to zero or one compared to half. And those are, that's energetics. And the point is that the zero or one is all screened. It's only over the penetration depth, right? Then you get any currents and fields. So that's a nice finite energy compared to this log. Of course, we haven't talked about the core energy, and it wouldn't come in, but, you know, but there's also the actual core itself. You know, the more low-lying excitations you have, usually the more energy would be associated with your core. You know, the fact that you do have a zero-energy excitation, which you probably wouldn't have in the full quantum vortex. But, you know, that may not be that big of a deal. But. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so you understand, there really is an energetic... Yes, topologically, there's nothing to... If you say you're, you know, for a theorist, you want your system to wind by pi, there's no choice, this is it. You've got a half-quantum vortex. But in any real material, it's going to make the, you know, is would it rather do that or just screen and have no vortex?
But if you do a quench, for example, then I presume you have to form?
Well, yes, yeah, that's true. Actually, Rafi's manuscript, he sometimes sees signatures of half quantum vortices in zero field upon cooling in that, and the idea being there that you're getting into a metastable state, and there's hysteresis effects from that. Yes, it's true. You would expect to see them sometimes coming out through, you know, even though energetically they're not favorable, you know, as long as the barrier isn't too high. Yeah, we'll have a lot more information when this paper is published.
Do continue to get logarithms if you have two half quantum vortices?
No, you don't. So people have thought about that. I mean, there's still, you know, there's an A logarithm, but then it goes with the separation. The thing with these topological, if you're really interested in the topological, the Majorana and fermions, you don't want to bring them too close together. They also have exponential tails. And, you know, when I say they're zero modes, you know, they're actually e to the minus L away from zero, where L is the distance to the next Majorana zero mode. So there's a little bit of playoff there in these, you know, in the more exotic physics. But yes, that's another idea. Having more than one.
I was also trying to understand this logarithmic divergence that you talked about. I think you said this, I just want to check that I've understood. The difference between that and the phase, the electromagnetic phase, is that one is coupled to a gauge field and one is not.
Right.
It's like the difference between, sometimes people talk about global monopoles or something. Like
probably. I personally never talk about monopoles, but but yes, so in the presence of, you know, because of that coupling to the gauge field, they're screening where beyond the penetration depth, everything falls off exponentially. Whereas with, you know, without that screening, you know, if you look at the superfluid velocity, it's just falling off like 1 over r. And you got, you know, your energy is basically mv squared, so you get 1 over r squared, and it's r dr, and that gives you your logarithm when you integrate it, right? I'm sure there's an analogy here in monopoles.
Could you just repeat the alpha exactly what it represented in that formula where you have...
For the phase there?
Something to do with the spin of the...
Yeah, so this alpha here?
Yeah.
That alpha? So... So as I change alpha, you know, if I took the S set equals zero state, I could represent it like this, where alpha equals zero would be if I was choosing my quantization axis along x. Okay. So anyway, as I change alpha here, I start with equal spin pairing along x. If I and an S set equals zero state, As I rotate alpha here, I'm changing from S set equals zero to S along some other direction is equal to zero. So I'm changing the spin state, but all in a way such that it has zero projection along some axis, which ensures that these amplitudes stay the same. you know, if you have zero projection along some axis, then these only change by phases. So the idea is that just like the charge part of your wave function, is acquiring a phase. So it's actually you're changing your wave function as you move around the vortex core. You're actually changing your spin state as you move around the vortex core. And if you really think about all these directions and Rafi's experiment where he's got his field in the x direction, what he needs to do, if he starts in an Sz equals zero state, he has to assume that he's moving in an S equals zero state that's in the Zy plane, such that the polarization is always in the x direction. But it's like if you start in Sz equals zero and energetically you can flip out of that, once you've applied a field, it will rotate in the Zy plane because that field wants the spontaneous spin polarization to be in the x direction energetically. So that will pick out the plane of rotation for the spin state.
So this is something like what's used in the Kalkin-Specker experiment, for those who know about that, I think. So instead of choosing your basis states to be Sz equals plus 1, 0, and minus 1, you choose them to be Sz equals 0, Sx equals 0, and Sy equals 0.
Well,
and then it's one of these basis states that's sort of winding around.
When I first started with my Sz equals zero state and decide to represent it as equal spin in the plane, there I was making a choice of basis, exactly whether I wanted it to be up, up, down, down, along x or y and that. What I'm talking about now is not a change of basis, because I'm starting from the state and it's acquiring a phase, so that state is changing.
It's like one of the dimensions of the basis.
It's not a change of basis unless you're working in a frame where you're changing your basis as the experiment's going on, right? It is really changing the state.
Okay, well, let's thank Catherine again.